Lecture 8, Martin Luther King, Jr., Stride Toward Freedom.
This is our eighth and last lecture in our series on the idea of freedom. And I've called this lecture Martin Luther King, Jr., Stride Toward Freedom. Martin Luther King, Jr. is probably the person best known to Americans among those we've discussed in this series, although he was assassinated at age 39, the same age that Malcolm X was assassinated. He made such a deep impression on our national consciousness that he's one of the very few public leaders for whom we've named a national holiday, an honor that could not be accorded to, say, Malcolm X, because Malcolm never gained Martin Luther King's all-American stature. Because so much has been published about King, especially the huge scholarly biographies by Taylor Branch and David Garrow, it's probably hard to say anything new about him. But our specific purpose here is to place King into the context of our series on the idea of freedom. And so, as I said, I've taken for the title of this lecture, Stride Towards Freedom, the title of King's own autobiography, to the extent that he did write an autobiography, which he called Stride Towards Freedom. This book is mainly about King's leadership of the Montgomery bus boycott, and the ideas that inspired that experience are discussed there. So in a few minutes, I'll be turning to that, the Montgomery bus boycott, as a dramatic example of the African-American struggle for freedom. It's not only the title of King's book, Stride Toward Freedom, that emphasized his concern for freedom. His speeches also make that emphasis. For example, his best-known speech, I Have a Dream, is only about 10 to 12 minutes long. But it mentions, that single speech mentions the word freedom, or free, or liberty, 25 times. In that speech, no other idea, not even King's concepts of equality and justice, of which he's so fond, receives more mention than that of freedom. If we examine King's speeches, then, and his writings closely, we see that he uses the term freedom in several different ways, and often, and all of them we have discussed so far in the context of the philosophers of freedom dealt with. In this sense, King, I think, is a good person to use to recapitulate or to summarize what we've said so far about the different meanings of freedom, because as a person who's familiar to us all, he helps us to understand these meanings in the context of our own American experience. So let's look at what he says about freedom and the ways in which he uses the word. King uses the term freedom and presents the idea of freedom in three specific ways. First, King was, of course, a Christian. He was a Baptist minister. So he understands freedom in the way that Christ meant it, as spiritual freedom. When he concludes his I Have a Dream speech with the old Negro spiritual, free at last, thank God Almighty, we are free at last, he's referring here, obviously, to a religious meaning of freedom in the context of that spiritual. That is, people may be set free, not just by a law or by a statute, but by the truth. That, as he often said, the truth shall set you free. In the Christian sense, we're liberated then from the sin of separateness, or from suffering an injustice by God's grace and by Christ's sacrifice. Other religious traditions, including Hinduism, espouse, as we've seen, the idea that the truth will set you free. And we've commented on that extensively. But King was a Christian, and he derived his idea from Christ's teachings, and he applied it to American race relations as no one else did. When he said that the truth shall set you free, as he often did, he meant free from the sin of separateness, from segregation, that the truth of human unity, of us all being children of God, would ultimately prevail and save us, black and white, from the illusion of separateness, from the untruth of racial segregation. Now, I'll return to this point later when I discuss King's analysis of Paul Tillich's theory. Tillich, the American Protestant theologian, said that sin is separation. But Tillich didn't apply it to race relations in the way that King did. Yet both come to the same conclusion that the truth may set us free. And this phrase that we've been using throughout since the first lecture, that the truth shall set you free, rings true and frequently true in King's writings. And I think of how often those of us who were involved in civil rights demonstrations sang the song, "We Shall Overcome." And there is, as some of you know, the verse, "The truth shall set us free." And how many times we sang that? I always off key, but my spouse who is here, I wish we could pause now and have us hear her rendition of "We Shall Overcome," with her voice singing, "The truth shall set us free." How many times we sang that in cities throughout the United States as we followed King's message of nonviolent protest. Well, think about this, about the truth setting us free. It was an abstraction, perhaps, when we quoted Christ's message, as we did earlier from St. John, "The truth shall set you free. Verily, verily, look unto me." That kind of message seemed, and then when we saw St. Augustine take up that same message, and then even Hegel. But now it becomes real, doesn't it? Or it should become real in terms of what it means to us as Americans. It's a kind of truth that liberates us from a sense of separateness, a truth that enables us to see the unity of the community here that we call the United States of America. We need desperately to view this country in terms of unity now, of a unity in our diversity. And from King's point of view, sin is separation, to be separated from one another as we are. As I, as an inhabitant of that great city of New York City, feel so often as I'm walking around that city, separated from so many strangers or enemies within that city. We need to get a truth here in terms of what we are. And that truth is that we are part of a common unity, and it's not necessary that we should live in constant fear in our major cities of one another. King said that truth should set us free, and that was his message. And we can sing it today as we sang it in the 60s. The second sense in which King used freedom was in the modern, secular, liberal, and democratic way that Locke and Mill used it. King led a civil rights movement, as we know, for the preservation of liberties, and he fought for the application of some of Locke's and Mill's liberal principles, especially for freedom of minorities in the face of political and social discrimination. From King's point of view, the phrase "tyranny of the majority," Mill's immortal dictum, had real meaning. Neither Locke nor Mill was concerned about the liberties of blacks in America. Certainly not in England, but King still took their ideas of freedom and reinterpreted them to apply to his own struggle for freedom in America. Both Locke and Mill believed in freedom in the sense of being free from arbitrary authority, and that is exactly the principle that King wanted and that he fought hard for, perhaps harder than Locke or Mill might have imagined, since it involved King being thrown into prison. Neither Locke nor Mill would sanction civil disobedience. Remember, liberty, but liberty always under law. The liberal principle that King drew on, but went beyond, we might say, or departed from, that was a radical principle that King used. Not liberty under law, but civil disobedience and nonviolent protest against unjust law, a theory and a practice that liberals like Mill and Locke under no circumstance would countenance. King then seized on the connection between freedom and justice that others had seen, but he made that connection his own. It is unfair, he told us, to practice unjust laws when our American Constitution sets forth principles of justice and freedom. It is unfair to enforce segregation in social behavior when we preach justice and equality in the name of freedom. It is unfair to isolate a small minority of our people and persecute them when we welcome to our shores the huddled masses yearning to breathe free. King fixed on this principle of justice and insisted that that principle complement the principles of equality and freedom in our own tradition as part of our heritage. In other words, King's genius was to use incomparable rhetoric to call on us and our democratic system to practice the Locke Mill principles of freedom that we promise. How he did it will be evident in the examples of the protests that he led, and we'll cite, discuss only one of them, the Montgomery bus boycott, in a moment. Now, I said that there were three senses in which King conceived of freedom. The first, remember, was the sense that we discussed in the very first lecture, the truth shall set us free, the religious sense, the context of spiritual freedom that he held so dear, and that is a way of using that phrase and that concept of freedom that King brought to us as an American in this century. And we, I think, should be grateful to him for having made that message ring true. The second sense that I mentioned was the liberal sense of freedom, which is not related to the spiritual and the religious directly, and that is the liberal sense of freedom is a secular message. And that is the Locke Mill principle of practicing a kind of freedom that would not emancipate individuals in a spiritual sense, but in a social and a political sense. Now, the third sense in which King conceived of freedom and used the term was the Gandhian meaning of Swaraj, to be pursued with nonviolence. That is, remember our ancient Indian concept of Swaraj, S-W-A-R-A-J. That is the first, seems to me, conceptualization of freedom that we have in the history of the world, set forth in the early Upanishads. That concept of Swaraj is renewed by Gandhi in the 20th century and linked to the idea of nonviolence. That is, we pursue Swaraj, we pursue freedom through nonviolent action. That was Gandhi's argument. King seizes on this and develops it. We've developed this connection of Swaraj to nonviolence in the Gandhi lecture when we talked about how he applied nonviolence in specific contexts, the Calcutta fast being one of them. So we should now note how King understood and applied these ideas to America. First of all, King understood better than Malcolm X that the freedom that Gandhi spoke of, called Swaraj, could be attained only through nonviolence. And that was his basic argument, an argument, of course, that Malcolm never made. King adopted then this important conceptual correspondence between freedom and nonviolence and applied it. King discussed at length this understanding in the context of the influence that Gandhi had on him, and he wrote about it especially in the book Stride Toward Freedom that we're working with now. In the chapter in Stride Toward Freedom called Pilgrimage to Nonviolence, King relates his own intellectual development, how he discovered Gandhi's teachings and then how he applied them to the Montgomery bus boycott of 1955-56. I'd like to read several paragraphs from Stride Toward Freedom that highlight Gandhi's influence because they suggest the all-important connection that both Gandhi and King made between freedom and nonviolent power. King first relates in Stride Toward Freedom, in this chapter, Pilgrimage to Nonviolence, how when he was 21 years old, in the fall of 1950, as a theology student at Crozier Seminary, he heard a lecture on Gandhi. And he was so inspired that he plunged into a serious study of Gandhi's teachings. He describes the effect that this had on him and how it led him to become involved in the bus boycott. And here's King's account of that moment when he is 21 years old in 1950. He says, "I traveled to Philadelphia to hear a sermon by Dr. Mordecai Johnson, president of Howard University. He was there to preach for the Fellowship House of Philadelphia. Dr. Johnson had just returned from a trip to India, and to my great interest, he spoke of the life and teachings of Mahatma Gandhi. His message was so profound and electrifying that I left the meeting and I immediately bought a half dozen books on Gandhi's life and works. Like most people, I had heard of Gandhi, but I had never studied him seriously. As I read, I became deeply fascinated by his campaigns of nonviolent resistance. I was particularly moved by the Salt March to the Sea and his numerous fasts. The whole concept of Satyagraha," Satyagraha is the word that Gandhi uses to describe nonviolent power. It's two components. Satya means truth, and agraha means holding on to. So one is holding on to the truth firmly in order to release the nonviolent power that ensues as a result. And King describes this here, the meaning of Satyagraha. "The whole concept of Satyagraha," he says, "was profoundly significant to me. As I delved deeper into the philosophy of Gandhi, my skepticism concerning the power of love gradually diminished, and I came to see for the first time its potency in the area of social reform. Prior to reading Gandhi, I had about concluded that the ethics of Jesus were only effective in individual relationships. The turn-the-other-cheek philosophy and the love-your-enemies philosophy were only valid, I felt, before, when individuals were in conflict with other individuals, when racial groups and nations were in conflict. A more realistic approach seemed necessary. But after reading Gandhi, I saw how utterly mistaken I was. Gandhi, I felt, was probably the first person in history to lift the love ethic of Jesus above mere interaction between individuals to a powerful and effective social force on a large scale. Love for Gandhi was a potent instrument for social and collective transformation. It was in this Gandhian emphasis on love and nonviolence that I discovered the method for social reform that I had been seeking for so many months. The intellectual and moral satisfaction that I failed to gain from the utilitarianism of Bentham or the revolutionary methods of Marx and Lenin or the social contract theory of Hobbes and Locke or the back-to-nature optimism of Rousseau, I found satisfaction finally in the nonviolent resistance philosophy of Gandhi. I came to feel that this was the only morally and practically sound method open to oppressed people in their struggle for freedom. In 1954, I ended my formal training with all of these relatively divergent intellectual forces converging into a positive social philosophy. One of the main tenets of this philosophy was the conviction that nonviolent resistance was one of our most potent weapons available to oppressed people in their search for social justice. At this time, however, I had merely an intellectual understanding and appreciation of the position, with no firm determination to organize it in a socially effective situation. When I went to Montgomery as a pastor, I hadn't the slightest idea that I would later become involved in a crisis in which nonviolent resistance would be applicable. I neither started the protest in Montgomery nor suggested it. I simply responded to the call of the people for a spokesperson. When the protest began, my mind, consciously or unconsciously, was driven back to the Sermon on the Mount with its sublime teachings on love and to the Gandhian method of nonviolent resistance. As the days unfolded, I came to see the power of nonviolence more and more. Living through the actual experience of the protest, nonviolence became more than a method to which I gave intellectual assent. It became a commitment to a way of life. Many of the things that I had not cleared up intellectually concerning nonviolence were now solved in the sphere of practical action. The biggest job in getting any movement off the ground is to keep together the people who form it. This task requires more than a common aim. It demands a philosophy that wins and holds the people's allegiance, and it depends upon open channels of communication between the people and their leaders. All these elements were found in Montgomery. So from the beginning, a basic philosophy guided the movement. This guiding principle has since been referred to variously as nonviolent resistance, non-cooperation, or passive resistance. But in the first days of the protest, none of these expressions was mentioned. The phrase most often heard was simply Christian love. It was the Sermon on the Mount, rather than a doctrine of passive resistance, that initially inspired the Negroes of Montgomery to dignified social action. It was Jesus of Nazareth that stirred the Negroes to protest with the creative weapon of love. As the days unfolded, however, the inspiration of Mahatma Gandhi began to exact its influence. I had come to see early that the Christian doctrine of love operating through the Gandhian method of nonviolence was one of the most potent weapons available to the Negro in his struggle for freedom. About a week after the protest started, a white woman who understood and sympathized with the Negro's efforts wrote a letter to the editor of the Montgomery Advertiser comparing the bus boat protest with the Gandhian movement in India. Miss Juliet Morgan, sensitive and frail, did not survive the rejection and condemnation of the white community. But long before she died in the summer of 57, the name of Mahatma Gandhi was well known in Montgomery. People who had never heard of the brown saint of India were now saying his name with an air of familiarity. Nonviolent resistance emerged as the technique of the movement, while love stood as the regulating ideal. In other words, Christ furnished the method and motivation, Gandhi furnished the method. Christ furnished the spirit and motivation, I should have said, and Gandhi furnished the method. Now that passage that I read, that long passage from Stride Towards Freedom, contains a number of points that are significant. When King says that he became committed to nonviolence, not simply as a tactic but a way of life, it became a commitment to a way of life, he's making an important point that Gandhi made, and that is that tactical nonviolence, or what Gandhi derided as passive resistance, was inferior by far to creedal nonviolence. That is, a nonviolence that commanded one's creedal assent, where nonviolence becomes a way of life. From King's point of view, this important shift from tactical nonviolence to creedal nonviolence was what made the Montgomery bus boycott successful, because individuals there believed in nonviolence not just as a tactic, but rather as a way of life. Now, that meant addressing the key problem of anger, because the hallmark of creedal nonviolence is to be able to cope with one's anger, use it effectively up to a point, but never direct it towards an individual in a way that dehumanizes that person. Always to hold the sin and not the sinner responsible, to be angry at the system and not at the self in the way that we saw. Creedal nonviolence necessarily demands that. A King goes further than this, and he mentions so many elements in this passage from Stride Towards Freedom that would merit comment. One is the reference to Juliet Morgan. Juliet Morgan was a librarian in Montgomery, Alabama in 1955. A person from a well-to-do white family in Montgomery. She was, as King describes here, sensitive and frail, but she had an extraordinary mind. That is, she wrote to the local newspaper, the Montgomery Advertiser, once the bus boycott began, a remarkable set of letters comparing the bus boycott to Gandhi's movement in India. She had somehow acquired a real intimate understanding of Gandhi's movement in India. When I read, as I did, these letters published in the Montgomery Advertiser, I was overwhelmed by her grasp of Gandhian principles. So Juliet Morgan writes these letters, and King, up until that time, he said, hadn't really got it together in terms of applying Gandhi to the Montgomery bus boycott. He reads these letters, and it is a white woman who signals to him the real significance of what he's doing. And King says this over and again. A biography should be written of Juliet Morgan. She was an inspiration to King at this time. And we need to know more about Juliet Morgan. Juliet Morgan, we're told, did not survive the opprobrium, the hatred of the white community, of some whites in Montgomery that surrounded her. She could not take the ostracism, the humiliation that was directed at her by some whites. And so she either committed suicide, we're not sure, or died of natural causes, but a young woman in her early 30s. Think of the sacrifice, but think of the inclusivity in that message. A white woman picking up on an Indian's exercise of nonviolent power, communicating it eloquently through the press in a series of letters to blacks in Montgomery. An extraordinary story. Now, he comes to the conclusion, then, that Christ furnished the spirit while Gandhi furnished the method. Without the method, from King's point of view, the power wouldn't have been there. And the Montgomery bus boycott is a way to link freedom and power. The story of the Montgomery bus boycott that King is telling here in the Stride Towards Freedom excerpts that I quoted began on December 1st. 1955, when, as you know, a person who has become immortal in American history, Rosa Parks, who last week commemorated King's I Have a Dream speech here in Washington, D.C., Rosa Parks boarded a bus in downtown Montgomery and said no to white authority by refusing to obey the segregation laws of Alabama on the city buses. A white passenger demanded her seat, and she said, "My feet hurt. I'm not going to do it." And while others around her were giving up their seats, as the law insisted, to whites when they so demanded, she refused. And as King said, that no reverberated through the 50s and 60s now to fire a protest of nonviolent non-cooperation. I will not stand for this. This is unfair. And Rosa Parks didn't need to read Plato's Republic on justice or any other treatise in order to have that inspiration. She knew it was unfair, and she acted. 48 hours after they booked Rosa Parks, after having arrested her in Montgomery, King and the leaders of the black community sent a bulletin addressed to the 50,000 blacks of Montgomery calling for a boycott on city buses, beginning Monday, December 5th, 1955. They also announced a mass meeting to decide how long the boycott should last. King phoned dozens of people that Sunday, but he awoke Monday morning not knowing how many blacks would join in the bus boycott, because a boycott of this kind was unprecedented. He describes, again in Stride Towards Freedom, what happened that Monday morning. "My wife and I awoke earlier than usual on Monday morning. We were up and fully dressed by 5:30. The day for the protest had arrived, and we were determined to see the first act of this unfolding drama. I was still saying that if we could get 60% cooperation, the venture would be a success. Fortunately, a bus stop was just 5 feet from our house. This meant that we could observe the opening stages from our front window. The first bus was to pass around 6 o'clock, and so we waited through an interminable half hour. I was in the kitchen drinking my coffee when I heard Coretta cry, 'Martin, Martin, come quickly.' I put down my cup, ran towards the living room. As I approached the front window, Coretta pointed joyfully to a slowly moving bus. 'Darling, it's empty.' I could hardly believe what I saw. I knew that the South Jackson line, which ran past our house, carried more Negro passengers than any other line in Montgomery, and that this first bus was usually filled with domestic workers going to their jobs. Would all of the other buses follow the same pattern that had been set by the first? Eagerly, we waited for the next bus. In 15 minutes, it rolled down the street, and like the first, it was empty. A third bus appeared. It, too, was empty of all but two white passengers. I jumped in my car. For almost an hour, I cruised down every major street, examined every passing bus. During this hour at the peak of the morning traffic, I saw no more than 8 Negro passengers riding the buses. By this time, I was jubilant. Instead of the 60% cooperation we had hoped for, it was becoming apparent that we had reached almost 100%. A miracle, it seemed, had taken place. The once dormant Negro community was now fully awake. Now, King knew from this moment, in December of 55, that a movement had been born. He plunged into organizing it. On that first day of the boycott, he and the other leaders formed the movement's organization, the Montgomery Improvement Association, as it was called. And King was named president of the Montgomery Improvement Association. By this time, Monday evening, the hour of the mass meeting had arrived, and King was called on to address the thousands that had crowded in and around the church. King normally took, he said, about 15 hours to prepare one of his Sunday sermons. Now, he says, he had only 15 minutes to think of what he would say. And yet the words poured out, and he later called it the most important speech of his life. This is what he said on December 5th, 1955, to that throng of people who would make history, a crowd of scared, courageous blacks who for the first time in their lives found themselves caught up in a movement to defy white racist authority in Montgomery. King first reviewed what had happened to Rosa Parks and then placed her story in the context of the long history of persecution that blacks had endured in Montgomery. And then he called the community to action. There comes a time, he said, that people get tired. We are here this evening to say to those who have mistreated us so long that we are tired. Tired of being segregated and humiliated. Tired of being kicked about by the brutal feet of oppression. We have no alternative now but to protest. For many years we have shown amazing patience. We have sometimes given our white brothers the feeling that we liked the way we were being treated. But we come here tonight to be saved from that patience that makes us patient with anything less than freedom and justice. One of the great glories of democracy is the right to protest for right. The White Citizens Councils, the Ku Klux Klan, these organizations are protesting for the perpetuation of injustice in the community. We're protesting for the birth of justice in our community. Their methods lead to violence and lawlessness. In our protest, there will be no cross burnings. No white person will be taken from his home by a hooded Negro mob and brutally murdered. There will be no threats and intimidation. We'll be guided by the highest principles of law and order. Our method will be that of persuasion, not coercion. We will only say to the people, let your conscience be your guide. Our actions must be guided by the deepest principles of our Christian faith. Love must be our regulating ideal. Once again, we must hear the words of Jesus echoing across the centuries, love your enemies, bless them that curse you, pray for them that despitefully use you. If we fail to do this, our protest will end up as a meaningless drama on the stage of history, and its memory will be shrouded with the ugly garments of shame. In spite of the mistreatment that we've confronted, we must not become bitter. We must not end up by hating our white brothers. As Booker T. Washington told us, let no man pull you so low as to make you hate him. If you will protest courageously and yet with dignity and Christian love, when the history books are written in future generations, the historians will have to pause and say, there lived a great people, a black people, who injected new meaning and dignity into the veins of civilization. This is our challenge and our overwhelming responsibility. The response to the speech has been well recorded because this speech is on tape. It's available in the King Archives in Atlanta. And we know how people responded to it. There was a moment of absolute silence. And then the audience just went absolutely wild. They suddenly realized that they had a real prophet in their midst who could speak as they had never heard before. This was a speech that made King. And it was a speech that transformed that moment. I would have loved to have been there myself. Think of it. I think if I had been there, I might have thought of Juliet Morgan's letters, in which she said in one of them, in the future, it might seem impossible now, but history will mark that this was Montgomery's finest hour. Think of a white woman saying that early on in the boycott. This will be regarded by history as Montgomery's finest hour. Well, King said that. This will be Montgomery's finest hour. And I'm not sure how people of Montgomery white and black review this today, but in our American history books, this is the most perfect act of nonviolent protest that's ever been registered. So with this speech, with King's speech, the man in history met. All the hopes and expectations suggested in this speech were fulfilled, so much so that if the Montgomery bus boycott is compared with any other nonviolent action in the country, I think it emerges as the best, a pure example at that point of the dream realized. After that speech, 50,000 blacks in Montgomery steadfastly, courageously, effectively, successfully refused to ride the buses for almost a year. Well recorded in the series that I'm sure many of you have seen called Eyes in the Prize, the documentary that focuses on the Montgomery bus boycott in the first part of that series. Then on November 13th, 1956, after the protest was fully registered, the United States Supreme Court, moved by the protest, declared Alabama laws requiring bus segregation unconstitutional. And by December 1956, a year after Rosa Parks said no to white authorities, buses in Alabama were integrated. Now, King is one of the very few practitioners of nonviolent action in America to develop a theory that underpinned the practice. His theory of nonviolence is elaborated throughout his writings, but there is a particular passage in his famous letter from Birmingham jail, after I might make an assignment, after reading Stride Towards Freedom, which is, as we said, his closest thing to an autobiography, even though he published it early in life, then read a letter from Birmingham jail, if you haven't. That is a kind of quintessential expression of nonviolent theory. He wrote it from jail, being imprisoned in Birmingham after an act of civil disobedience there. And the letter from Birmingham jail, maybe again, once again, because he had the time to think it through, it was a crystallization of his theory, a way that even better in a certain form than Stride Towards Freedom. So if we look to the letter from Birmingham jail, we can find several things there. It addresses the theme throughout of sin as separation. Remember that King had taken his Ph.D., at Boston, in University of Boston, theology, and he had written his Ph.D. dissertation partly on Paul Tillich's theology, and so he's specially attuned to Tillich's work, and he writes then a lot on the theme of sin as separation that I mentioned earlier. This theme shows how King adapted religious teachings to a justification of breaking the law and going to prison. The passage, I think, is also a fine example of how King extended Gandhi's theory of nonviolence by bringing in philosophers that Gandhi never knew, such as St. Thomas Aquinas or Martin Buber or Paul Tillich. King writes this in a letter from Birmingham jail. Remember, he had argued in the earlier speech that I quoted that the Negroes were not breaking the law. They were respecting the highest laws of the land. And that was his basic argument. The Negroes were respectful of the highest laws. It's just that they were, as the protest continued, they were evidently breaking the local laws, the state laws of Alabama. So King was hard put to make the distinction between what laws he was obeying and what laws he was not. And the letter from Birmingham jail was a direct reply to liberals, we might say Lockean Millian liberals, who were saying, hey, this is a democracy. There's no need to break the law. You're going too fast. And these liberals, who were black clergymen, many of them, pressed their case to King. And King, writing this letter then, responds to them. And the charge against King is that he's a flaming radical. He's breaking the law. He's going to prison. He does not have respect for the principles of this country. And King addresses this then. He says, one may well ask, how can you advocate breaking some laws and obeying others? The answer lies in the fact that there are two types of laws, just and unjust. I would be the first to advocate obeying just laws. One has not only a legal, but a moral responsibility to obey just laws. Conversely, one has a moral responsibility to disobey unjust laws. I would agree with St. Augustine that an unjust law is no law at all. Now, what is the difference, King asks, between the two? How does one determine whether a law is just or unjust? A just law, King argues, is a man-made code that squares with a moral law or the law of God. An unjust law is a code that is out of harmony with a moral law. To put it in the terms of St. Thomas Aquinas, an unjust law is a human law that is not rooted in eternal law and natural law. Any law that uplifts human personality is just. Any law that degrades human personality is unjust. All segregation statutes are unjust because segregation distorts the soul and damages the personality. It gives the segregator a false sense of superiority and the segregated a false sense of inferiority. Segregation, to use the terminology of the Jewish philosopher Martin Buber, substitutes an I-it relationship for an I-thou relationship, and ends up relegating persons to the status of things. Hence, segregation is not only politically, economically, and sociologically unsound, it is morally wrong. It is sinful. Paul Tillich has said that sin is separation. Is not segregation an existential expression of man's tragic separation, his awful estrangement, his terrible sinfulness? Thus it is that I can urge men to obey the 1954 decision of the Supreme Court, Brown versus Board of Education, for it is morally right, and I can urge them to disobey segregation ordinances, for they are morally wrong. This is sophisticated theory. He has resurrected the natural law doctrine and applied it ingeniously, it seems to me, to race relations in the United States. Not the natural law doctrine in terms of political theory is an elusive doctrine. And the problem is that because we can't see it or define it or put it into statutes easily, it can be used either way to justify, from what would be from King's point of view, unjust action, as well as to condemn it. But natural law theory was used early on by our founding fathers, especially by Thomas Jefferson, to inspire this country in the Declaration of Independence. And whether we like natural law or not, when we look to the founding of this country, we can't do without it and we can't deny it. It's there. And natural law doctrine is, of course, that we're all created equal, that we have a right to pursue life, liberty, and happiness. Now, those ideas King takes, and after quoting Thomas Aquinas, that is to put it in the terms of Thomas Aquinas, an unjust law is a human law that is not rooted in eternal law and natural law. Yes, Aquinas did say that, but then notice how King makes the leap. Any law that uplifts human personality is just. Any law that degrades human personality is unjust. Aquinas didn't say that. He probably should have said it, and to be more clear, but King says it. And he's got then this theme of humanization, dehumanization built into his theory and into his practice in a highly creative manner. Now, when King argues then, after that, that all segregation statutes, because they divide us, are by natural law illegal, and that we are being lawful when we obey natural law, he's turning the tables right around. He's arguing as Antigone did in the great play by Sophocles, by that name. Antigone approaches the Greek tyrant Creon and says, I am obeying a natural law, and that law is the eternal law, the law of the gods. King goes back to that message, that old natural law doctrine, that there is a moral law, a higher law, that if we will obey it, uplifts us and gives us sustenance in this time of terror and turmoil. That is the law that must be applied against the practice of segregation. This is a really nice application, it seems to me, of Buber and Tillich to the problem. Neither Buber nor Tillich took on the cause of the African American. They might have if it had been put to them, but they didn't. King interprets them in such a way that it becomes a part of his idea. Sin is separation. Segregation is sin. We need to look closely at King. He's a theorist of the first order who manages to apply the theory to practice in the context of his own struggle. Later in the letter from Birmingham jail, King returns to his favorite theme of freedom. Oppressed people, he says, cannot remain oppressed forever. The yearning of freedom eventually manifests itself, and that is what has happened to the American Negro. Something within has reminded him of his birthright of freedom, and something without has reminded him that it can be gained. Now, Martin Luther King, it seems to me, is an excellent person to conclude this lecture series with for many reasons. He's significant, it seems to me, though, above all, because he not only tried to practice what he preached, but he called on us with incomparable eloquence to practice what we preach, the democratic ideal of freedom and justice for all. He saw that among the freedoms that we seek was one that we especially need, and that is freedom from fear, and he applied that to his situation. The path to liberation, he argued, lies in the practice of nonviolence. Violence ended King's life, but his increased stature in America since his death shows that his voice was not silenced. 75,000 people gathered last week in Washington, D.C., and that was thousands more than on any previous occasion to commemorate his I Have a Dream speech. It was said on this day that we need another king to bring this country together. But perhaps it's more accurate to say that we need together to take another stride towards freedom.
I'm Tom Rollins, president of the Teaching Company. We hope you've enjoyed the lectures on these tapes. To order more courses or to receive a copy of our most recent catalog, call 1-800-TEACH-12. That's 1-800-TEACH-12. Or visit us on the internet at www.teachco.com. That's teachco.com. Thank you very much for listening.